Let's review this first problem. C6H13Br. What degree of unsaturation do we have for that compound? Zero. Let's review the formula for degree of unsaturation. And remember that when we have something that's fully saturated, that means it doesn't have any double or triple bonds. It also means it doesn't have any rings. So it also means there are no coffee cups that it would have visible in the lab. It's empty. Okay. You're just bad luck with getting caught this quarter. That's all, isn't it? So, if we had just an average organic compound, what would be the number of hydrogens that it's supposed to have based on the number of carbons? 2C plus 2. So we start out with degree of unsaturation being compared to the number of hydrogens it normally would have, which is that 2C plus 2. But we have to make some adjustments, don't we? Because this assumes no heteroatoms. Some heteroatoms change the count, some don't. For example, chalcogens like oxygen and sulfur. How would they affect the count here? Oxygen and sulfur. Would we need to adjust the number of hydrogens we expect if we had oxygen or sulfur on the molecule? No, because they're both divalent atoms. So, for example, if you have a carbon-hydrogen bond, you can insert an oxygen in that bond, and it doesn't change the number of hydrogens you'd need to keep everything neutral. But what if you had a halogen, chlorine or something like that? Will we change the number of hydrogens? What would we do? We would subtract one for each halogen. So we're going to say minus X. What about pnictogens, like nitrogen and phosphorus? Then we would add. So 2C plus 2 minus X plus N is the base number that we expect for a fully saturated compound. We then compare to how many hydrogens we really do have. And since one degree of unsaturation involves a pair of hydrogens, we then take that difference and divide it by two. So in this case, six carbons, 2C plus 2, that would give us 14, but we do have a halogen, so we subtract, and that gives us 13, which is how many we do have, which is why it's a degree of unsaturation of zero. So we know that means there's no rings, and there's no double or triple bonds. We know we have a halogen, which is going to be the reason we have such a high chemical shift. The fact that we do have such a high chemical shift is a good clue. We do have the halogen on the same carbon as there are hydrogens. Now, last quarter, we did have a series of problems where part of the solution was to realize some form of trick. For example, we did problems where there was symmetry in the molecule. We did problems where just knowing the degree of unsaturation almost led us to the answer. Now, this problem may not have such an obvious trick, but there is one thing here that stands out that is related to one of those problem-solving approaches we took last quarter. Can anybody figure out what is notable in this information, these peaks that are given to us? Six hydrogens. Why is that noteworthy? It means there is some sort of symmetry because you can't have one carbon that has more than four hydrogens on it. In fact, never would you have four itself unless you have the molecule methane. So normally the maximum number of hydrogens, which means the maximum integration, would be three. The fact that we have six means one of a few things. Either we have two methyl groups, which is actually the most likely thing, because given the small number of atoms, it's not out of the ordinary to have two methyl groups the same. So 2 times 3 gives us 6. We could, in theory, have 3 methylenes, 3 CH2 groups, but that would mean they'd all have to be identical, which, given the number of other peaks that we have, which implies the number of other types of hydrogens that we have, and given that limited number of atoms, not likely to be 3 pairs. Of course, the even more unlikely case for this problem would be having 6 equivalent hydrogens, which if you had benzene, just the molecule benzene, that does have six equivalent hydrogens, six individual ones. Not likely to happen here. So based on the integration of six, the molecule likely has two equivalent methyl groups. And again, specifying that that's also based on the small number of atoms and the number of other peaks. So here are two methyl groups. In these situations, the most common thing to have happen is the two methyl groups are part of some sort of branch. In other words, you'll have a common carbon that then splits off in two directions, and those two directions are identical. Now let's see what we can do here. All right, here's the six hydrogens, which I'm going to color code, which I know on this projector is not going to show up well, but I am color coding it purple at the moment. Now, what kind of splitting are these six hydrogens going to cause? Quartet, right? Because even though there's six hydrogens, there's only three in either location. So whatever group I put next to it is not going to experience all six hydrogens at once. So it's fine that we don't have a heptet somewhere here. So this is maybe a little different than some problems we've seen in the past, but it's because of this symmetry. So we know, though, that there needs to be a quartet. There's only one place we can find a quartet here. That's the third peak that's listed. So I'm going to go ahead and circle the quartet in purple to show that it's this first set of methyl groups that caused that. We could also look at the methyl groups themselves and see that they have triplet splitting. Now, let's review what splitting is very briefly. So remember that the type of absorbance that you get is all due to the magnetic field that is around the nucleus being scanned. So not only, though, is there the main magnetic field that's part of the machine, there's the environment around it, what the other nuclei have as far as their own spins. So if you have a neighbor that has a spin aligned with the magnetic field, that's going to add to the overall magnetic field that's experienced by the nucleus being scanned. Or if the neighbor is oriented opposite, then it's going to end up subtracting from that magnetic field. Since both possibilities are likely, and on average they're equally likely, that means given a solution, a sample that's got zillions of molecules, they will experience both of those things. That by having one neighbor, you'll get two different absorbances. And that's the origin of this N plus 1 rule. Because it turns out if you have two neighbors, you get three absorbances. Three neighbors, four absorbances. So the fact that we have a triplet here means there's two neighbors. The fact, though, that we have two equivalent methyl groups that have two neighbors means, again, that this peak that integrates to four is going to correspond to the next thing up the chain. So let's go ahead and write those hydrogens in. Noting them in blue. So again, that's what causes the methyl groups to be a triplet. And because of the symmetry, they integrate to four. Now look at what other piece of information that we have next. That the neighbor only has one hydrogen on it. We know because there's only a doublet. So we had doublet of quartets, which means on one side of the last set of hydrogens we looked at, we have that methyl group, that's the quartet. But on the other side of it, we only have one hydrogen that's there. Now, think about the number of carbons that we have. Because we could wonder if there are, again, two carbons equivalent to each other, each one with just one hydrogen, because that would correspond integrating to a doublet, or to integrating to two. And we do have a peak that integrates to two. And then that peak that integrates to two is split into just a doublet. And we can see, oh, well, that means there would be one neighbor, and we do have a peak that integrates to one. But if we had the two side chains, each of which had three carbons, well, that's all six carbons in the compound. Where are we going to put one bromine left over, but somehow have everything be symmetric? So it doesn't add up. We notice also, though, that we have quintet splitting on one of these peaks. Quintet means you have four equivalent neighbors. Well, we could have four equivalent neighbors if at this point in the compound we join those side chains. And so this new hydrogen here, if we only allow there to be one hydrogen, that would match the splitting of the blue protons that we just came from. If there is only one hydrogen, that would correspond to an integration of one, which, because it has those four equivalent neighbors, would explain the quintet. The fact that it's a triplet shows that it has another carbon neighbor, which is why it only has one hydrogen its own self. At this point, all that's left is that carbon, two remaining hydrogens, and then the bromine, which means the structure of the compound is this. Let's finish the assignments to make sure that this makes sense. So this last peak has two hydrogens that integrate, therefore, to two, or matches this peak with an integral of two. It also matches that its neighbor, the green hydrogen, has a triplet in it. And then because the neighbor is only a single hydrogen, that's why that last carbon is itself split into a doublet. So I realized on the lab quiz you had more time than this even to solve a problem, but how many of you were able to get this problem? Okay, a moderate number. If you didn't get the problem, hopefully it made sense as we worked through it, and we will review the other sets of problems given at the end of last quarter, so we'll have more chance to review before we get new stuff. Any questions before we move on to the second problem? All right, let's do that second problem. And you know, the first problem, I guess, let me just briefly read out those absorbances because I didn't do it so for the recording. It was C6H13Br, 3.460, a doublet for two hydrogens, 1.45, a triplet of quintets for one hydrogen, 1.427, doublet of quartets for four hydrogens, and then 0.895, a triplet for six hydrogens. The second problem was C6H10O, which had six absorbances. It was 5.79 for a doublet of triplets that integrated to one. 5.02, that was a doublet of doublets for one hydrogen. 4.97, that was a doublet of doublets for one hydrogen. 2.52, that was a triplet of two hydrogens. 2.34, that was a doublet of two hydrogens. And then finally, 2.149, that was a singlet integrating to three. So we can work this problem purely off of splitting and integration, at least most of the problem. You then have to make a small but logical leap, which I'll show you when we get there. But before we try to do the systematic approach, let's see if there's any of these tricks or observations, these realizations that we had last quarter that would help us come up with some possible structural pieces of this molecule. Is there anything about the chemical shift that strikes you in this compound? Well, let's back up a step. What's the degree of unsaturation? Two. So given its chemical formula and the fact that it's got a degree of unsaturation of two, that means we could have
a triple bond, which if we did, that means we would have either an ether or an alcohol. We could have a carbonyl and an alkene. We could have a carbonyl and a ring. We could have an alkene in a ring, or we could have two different rings. Now, does that last option of just having two rings make sense with the chemical shift values that we've got? Not particularly, especially given that we have three different absorbances, each of them almost at five. We'd need some really strange molecule that has lots of different inequivalent carbons to be able to generate something like that if all we had was an oxygen, not a double bond or something else to cause those chemical shifts. So I'm suggesting maybe the double ring option is not that valid. If you had good test-taking skills, you would say the alkyne is not valid, because we never did any alkynes last quarter. Because we're going to do alkynes this quarter, so you can't make that kind of leap anymore. But, you know, all the other options have some kind of double bond in them. Now, does anybody remember roughly what the range is of alpha hydrogens, alpha to a carbonyl? What would a ketone be as far as its chemical shift? Didn't really expect you to remember, but it's about 2.0 to 2.3. And notice that we have a singlet integrating to 3 that has a chemical shift in that range. Why do I point this out? Because anytime you have a singlet, that means you have no hydrogen neighbors on the next carbon over. So just a reminder here, if we have a singlet, that integrates to 3, then it would be something like these different methyl groups. Because again, on their neighbors, there are no hydrogens. So we could have an ether if we had just 1 degree of unsaturation in terms. Let's see. We could have an ether if, yes, we had an alkene and a ring, for example. Then the oxygen would have to be saturated. But that chemical shift, it's kind of strange to have it all the way up at 5. That is a little high. And having 3 different hydrogens, just single hydrogens. You can't have an ether that has more than 2 carbons on it. So somehow making 2 of the hydrogens on the same carbon different from each other to generate these chemical shifts, that's kind of a complicated problem. So carbonyl looks like a really strong candidate for explaining the singlet in this case. But let's return one last time to these high chemical shifts. Because what functional group that we could get out of this degree of unsaturation would make sense having that high chemical shift? Where does an alkene show up? Oh, no recollection for that. About 5 to 6. This is right in the range for one. What about the integrations would maybe support the idea of having an alkene? What kind of alkene would this be based on the integrations? What's that? Terminal. Why? Because only a terminal alkene would have 3 hydrogens on it. And the very end carbon, because the configuration is locked in by that double bond, the 2 hydrogens on that same carbon would be different from each other. Because one would have cis interaction with its neighbor, one would have trans interaction. They would be different. That would explain the 3 single absorbances and also the complicated splitting pattern. Doublet of triplets. So I'm going to guess there's a double bond. And I'm also going to suggest there's some good evidence for there being a ketone in here. So let me write some of this down that I just
rambled through. So, this molecule likely contains an alkene, since there are multiple peaks with a chemical shift about 5, each of which only integrates to 1. The alkene would be terminal. Since that is the only way to have 3 individual hydrogens. And then I'm also going to make the brief note here that the compound also appears to have a carbonyl. Based on the singlet that integrates to 3, with a chemical shift between 2.0 and 2.3.
So having made these guesses, let's now go back and try to do it systematically.
Which, let me do this here so we can see the peak still.
So let's take that singlet integrating to 3
and just figure out what the significance of that is. You would have a carbon with 3 hydrogens that would have some kind of neighbor that again would have no hydrogens on it. I'll circle these methyl group hydrogens black since they're not going to be split by anything.
Where would I go next? My suggestion would be to handle the triplet. Why? Because the fact that it's only a triplet and not a triplet, a doublet, a triplet, a quartet, some complex splitting, means it only has neighbors on one side. But since it itself only integrates to 2, that means that position also has something next to it that is blocking splitting. And there's the strong likelihood that it's going to be the same thing that blocks the splitting for the methyl group. We can't make that assumption yet, but given the limited number of atoms, very high likelihood.
So we have a carbon with 2 hydrogens on it. That would explain the integration of 2. The fact that it's a triplet means it has a neighbor, that neighbor has 2 hydrogens on it. There is one other peak that integrates to 2, so we must have automatically figured out which peak that is. We look at that peak, it is split into a triplet, which would match with the methylene that we just came from, but it's also got a doublet. A doublet means that it's got one individual hydrogen on its neighbor. We have 3 peaks
that have an integration of 1. Which one would this green hydrogen be? The one with the doublet of triplets? Because of the methylene group that we just came from. It has 2 neighbors on one side, so it has to have a triplet somewhere. The fact that it's a doublet of doublets
meshes with this idea that the molecule is an alkene. Because, look, we've used up four carbons already, and the molecule only has six. We know if there's a doublet of doublets, that means there is a neighboring carbon that has two hydrogens on it, two different hydrogens on it. There is another way to get two different hydrogens, which is if they're somehow enantiotopic or diastereotopic. But even if they were enantiotopic, that would only matter in chiral solvents, which I don't even know if I even specified that on the quiz. And, well, we never did a problem with those kinds of hydrogens. So, again, based on the degree of unsaturation chemical shift, we're going to guess this is really a double bond that's here. So here's that green hydrogen that is split by the methylene group. Now this section would have ended up with part of the problem unsolvable. Because we do have these two remaining hydrogens, but we don't have enough information to tell which of the remaining two peaks corresponds to which of those hydrogens. Because they have the same splitting, the same integration, and virtually the same chemical shift. It is not always true that something cis has a lower chemical shift than trans, nor the reverse. Often it's more complicated than that. So for them, they would have needed to identify this much, and then whatever they said for the remaining hydrogens would have been okay. Let me just go ahead and circle these other hydrogens, though, and color code them arbitrarily. So I don't remember now from the database where I got this, which one is which, my own self. But if we got this far in the problem, it doesn't really matter. Now what's left, though? Because we've used up now five of the carbons and all 10 of the hydrogens. We haven't used one carbon. We haven't used the oxygen. That's a carbonyl. Fits right in where the question marks go. And so that means the answer is this. Now, how many of you got this problem? Not as many, but that's the same thing that happened with the other sections. It was a trickier problem. Questions on this one, though? Then we're going to switch into lecture mode just briefly, because I would like to have that small discussion on pKa values. Normally this would be done in lecture, but I missed a day, so we're trying to make up. Let me first write down a sequence of compounds, including an ester. And there's nothing special about these examples. I'm trying to make them as generic as possible, in fact, just to give us a range for a pKa value. It's a ketone, an aldehyde, and an alcohol. It's one set of molecules to compare. Now, another sequence of molecules. A diester, a molecule that has two carboxylate groups on either end versus an oxoester, compound that has a ketone on one side, ester on the other, versus a diketone versus an oxoaldehyde, one side a ketone, one side an aldehyde, versus a dialdehyde. Now let me indicate on each one of these compounds which of the hydrogens I'm actually worried about. Now we know the pKa values for some of these, or we better by now, because do we really want another whiny soapbox lecture about not falling behind on studying? So what is the pKa of the ketone that I gave? Roughly. Closer to 19, and actually, in some textbooks, closer to 20. So if you do go look at other resources, you may find numbers that vary slightly from the numbers I'm giving you. Especially in this last sequence, because I'm going to kind of fudge the numbers just a touch to make them easier to memorize. Because we really care about the trends more than we know to the 50th decimal place the real value of these pKa's.
So I'm still going to match what I said earlier and call the ketone 19. What was the aldehyde's rough acidity? 16. In some texts, 16.7, but we'll call it 16. What would be the alcohol's pKa? 18's more for tertiary alcohol, so this one's going to be 16. Now, what was the origin of the difference in acidity between the ketone and the aldehyde? Hyperconjugation. So, I'm going to make a blanket statement that's going to be true in two different ways. The statement is this. The carbonyl stabilizes whatever enolate is formed. But if the carbonyl is distracted, you could say, by some other group next to it, or to be less anthropomorphic, if something donates electron density to the carbonyl, then the carbonyl is less able to delocalize an enolate. If it's less able to delocalize it, that means it doesn't want to form. And if it doesn't want to form, that means the hydrogen never wants to come off, meaning it's not as acidic. So, a ketone has two alkyl groups, one on each side of the carbonyl. Both of those alkyl groups are able to undergo hyperconjugation. Hyperconjugation gives electron density to the carbonyl. That means the carbonyl can't tolerate the enolate as well, which means the hydrogen doesn't come off as easily, which is why a ketone is not as acidic as an aldehyde, because an aldehyde only has one alkyl group that can undergo hyperconjugation, because the hydrogen on the other side is 90 degrees to the pi bond and therefore can't undergo hyperconjugation. So automatically less stabilization, and automatically therefore the aldehyde is more acidic. Now, didn't I write all that down at the time we first talked about the acidity of these two compounds? But I'm going to write part of that down again, because it's the same story that we're going to use for the ester. In fact, based on what I just said, predict the pKa of the ester. You're saying less than 16 for the ester? Do I hear any other suggestions? Because why would you say less than 16? What would that mean about the ester? Okay, so Alice's answer was, well, both oxygens are really electronegative. So we have the one carbonyl oxygen that's pulling the electron density away, and of course it's delocalizing. But remember about activators and deactivators from last quarter. Even though oxygen's electronegative, it also has the ability to do resonance. What would resonance do to this carbonyl? It would make it actually harder for the carbonyl to tolerate the enolate, wouldn't it? So yes, the oxygen's electronegative, but overall it provides more electron density. More than hyperconjugation could, because this is actual delocalization. So if the difference between an aldehyde and a ketone was because of simply hyperconjugation, there's going to be at least that much difference between the ketone and the ester. And there is, because the pKa is roughly 24 or 25.
Now, in section one, I learned, because instructors, they should or could learn, that resonance is actually the answer both here for why something is less acidic, but also for why in this next set of compounds something is more acidic. And if all you do is say resonance, then it's understandable that somebody on the other side listening will say, no, wait a minute. Okay, resonance is making this less acidic, but resonance is making this more acidic. And yes,
It's not a contradiction. Because resonance is occurring even before the hydrogen comes off of an ester.
Let me show you this little structure bit as an aside here. It is not a good resonance structure that I'm about to write. Because I'm taking a molecule in which everything formally has a neutral charge. And I'm now generating something that has charge separation. And you might recall, in the rules for writing resonance structures that you learned in 1A, if you have charge separation, that means you have a poorer resonance structure. But poorer does not mean insignificant. Poorer just means that's not the main mode or main way we would describe the structure of the molecule. But there's charge that's delocalized here. Now consider what would happen. In this case, you've deprotonated and made the enolate, but you still have the lone pair. Both of them are competing for the carbonyl, you could say. And again, if you have something other than the enolate that is interacting with that carbonyl, it makes that carbonyl less able to interact with the enolate, making it less stable, making it less likely to form, meaning that it's not as acidic to start with. Let me write that part of it down. When electron density is provided to a carbonyl, by either hyperconjugation or delocalization, the partial positive charge on the carbonyl carbon is reduced. Meaning that delocalization of a neighboring negative charge is less likely. Or less favorable.
Meaning an enolate would be more difficult to form. Meaning the corresponding alpha proton would be less acidic. Again, this is due to hyperconjugation or resonance before the hydrogen comes off. Look at this next set of compounds. We have two carbonyls, one on either side of the hydrogen, which means the hydrogen, if you wanted to call it this way, is double alpha. Well, if being alpha is what caused these hydrogens to be acidic in the first place, what's double alpha going to mean? They're even more acidic because of resonance. Okay, now wait a minute. We just got done saying resonance caused something to be less acidic. Why is it now more acidic? Because the resonance doesn't even happen until that hydrogen comes off. right? There is no delocalization going on between the two carbonyls. Well, there is, but that's an exception we'll get to later. There's a tautomerization that is favorable for some of these compounds just because of an interaction we'll see later on. But for right now, if I take the hydrogen off, you then form a negative charge that then will delocalize. Because that delocalization only happens once the hydrogen comes off, then if you make it easier to delocalize, you make it easier for the hydrogen to come off, which means you've made it more acidic. So in all of these compounds, even the diester, they're more acidic than any of the compounds we saw before. And again, these are kind of fudged values a little bit, but here they are. A nice decreasing sequence of odd numbers, 13, 11, 9, 7, 5. Notice that the same trend as far as whether we have an alkoxy or alkyl or hydrogen group next door, that same trend of becoming more and more acidic as we go from alkoxy to alkyl to hydrogen is present. So, for this group, resonance stabilizes the anion formed, so the alpha hydrogens are more acidic. Now, we'll revisit some of this when we get into alpha chemistry in week 3. I say week 3 because even though it is slightly overdue, we do have a list of topics and quiz and exam dates now, which I'll go over once we get to lecture, because that's more appropriate in a lecture recording. But we will start alpha chemistry in week 3. Any question about these alpha hydrogens that we just finished discussing? Then what we need to do today is to do the IR. I don't know if I said already, but we're not going to do NMR, at least of this sample, because it's not the easiest thing for us to characterize. There's some other samples that would be better if we're going to do NMR. We do have a solid, so for, let's see, have you done a solid IR doing a KBR pellet before? Yes, you have. Okay, if not, you got a room full of people who have done it before, so I'm sure they would gladly volunteer to help you out. Recall that the KBR needs to be dry, so I'm hoping section 2 didn't leave the KBR out like section 1 did yesterday. If they did, you need to put it in the oven for maybe 5 or 10 minutes before you use it. If we've run out, there's more in the stock room, so we can refill it. Please, I know at one point I put in an all-glass jar or something that didn't have a plastic lid because, you know, plastic and oven, those two things don't go together very well. And yet every quarter it seems like someone wants to put the plastic lid on that glass jar just so it melts shut, just so we can have the fun of trying to open it up again. Now, some of you might not get through your IRs today. I can tell some of you are already getting ready, and I'm going to move physically out of the way here because as soon as I raise this board up, there is the need for you all to put your names up in a list of who gets to do the IR first. And this is just like section 2. You all act polite for a moment, but then when the moment comes, when the first person moves, the whole class is leaping up to the board. So let's try to not make this into a New York subway scene here. But if you are done with all of your synthesis, if no one in here is doing synthesis, we don't need goggles in this room because all the chemicals are going to be in that other room there. But if any of you were absent and need to do the lab, or if you didn't finish the lab, then while that's going on, we will need to have goggles. Any solids you have, because we're not doing NMR, they can go into the organic waste, because recall that anything that's solid can go into a waste container labeled liquid. We just can't put liquids in something labeled solids. The next lab is going to be the Robinson annulation.
And sorry, this is squeezed in the bottom here, but let me tell you. Lab number two. Are you all waiting to leap? Is that what's going on? So, Robinson annulation. We have theory. That's on page 625 to 628. And then the experiment itself is 628 to 629. Same things as for this experiment. Make sure that you experiment part. The theory part I won't check. However, I find the mechanism for this experiment incredibly interesting. Which you know that's my language for, it's going to be on the lab quiz. So you might want to make sure you've read the theory part at least. It's going to be the mini scale, not the micro scale. And I would again suggest leaving room for an adjustment of quantities. So I will be checking pre-labs on Tuesday.